Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss, Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers.
You're now listening to Greg. It's the Brothers Wiss.
Hey, everybody. This is Greg from Texas with the Brothers Wiss number 103. Man, we are right on the cusp of Christmas, and today the only present you get is one Thomas Kurnick.
Hello, everyone.
All the way from Slovakia. Would you consider that the motherland?
I don't know. I don't claim any partiality to any single country or, you know, region of land. So, I don't know. I'm just a child of the earth.
A child of the earth. I always say Texas is the motherland. I've lived only in one other state, so I don't know. It was nice there. After a fashion. I mean, you know, I left and came back, so I don't know. It called to me, the siren song of Texas. And there's a lot of variety here. There's like mountain, well, there's hill country. You can't really say it's mountains here. And then you got plains, you got a little bit of desert. You got up in the panhandle where it gets really cold. You got kind of by the ocean. So you get a little bit of everything, right? Piney trees. Is there that much variety over there in Slovakia?
Not really, honestly. It's just we have a lot of hilly country and we have a lot of flat country, but that's about it.
Sounds fantastic. All right, so since we
there are many castles.
Many castles?
Yeah, it's like you take a stroll in Slovakia and like eat every 10 minutes anywhere you go by car, there's a castle and another castle and there's another castle. So, yeah.
So all of you people live in castles, is what you're saying? Or is that the dream? Is that what every good Slovakian dreams?
I think that's, yeah, that's like the goal. That's the objective, yeah. I mean, I would live in a castle, assuming other people would take care of it. You know, I would go for that.
Sounds like a lot of upkeep, a lot of trouble. I'm not sure it's worth it.
That's a good description.
All right, so something that always fascinates me about you and other people from magical places that I assume exist but don't really know for sure are your various traditions, right? So Christmas is coming up, or the holiday season, however you want to say it, right? Everybody believes something different. I was just curious, what's a traditional Christmas like in Slovakia? What does every Slovakian kid dream of?
Yeah, it's very traditional. It's very Christian. Like the country is, I think, 85% Christian, Roman Catholic to be exact. There's a bunch of traditions that pretty much everybody follows, and it's very different from the US.
So, do you guys do like Boxing Day? Is that a thing for you?
Boxing Day.
Yeah. So like in England, the day after Christmas, they have this thing called Boxing Day. From what I understand, it's like you give some of your old stuff or maybe something like that over to your friends. I don't know. I think I read up on it. It was something like some kind of tradition where like the rich people would like hand out their old crappy stuff they didn't want to wear anymore to like the servants and stuff like that. So. Do you hand down any of your, I'm not exactly sure if that's how it works or not. I'm assuming people just sort of do kind of a gift exchange anyway after Christmas.
There's probably somebody who's British and very angry at us now.
I hope so. We've got several British guys that listen. They're really shaking their heads. I know they also, yeah, do, exactly. Right. I watch so much British television. I see them do the Christmas crackers and they do the Christmas puddings and stuff. And it looks very quaint and cute and charming. I was just curious if you had any similar things.
Not anything that you described.
Okay. I mean, the only thing I know about, so I have some Catholic friends and they, everything's very, I guess, very structured, very oriented. You know, it's like, you know, you go to church and you're there for a week and then you come out and then you kind of do some various things. I assume that's what most of you guys do.
Yeah, that's a good description. And wow. Wow.
Oh, Mike Hammett, you joined the TriCast ahead of time. I'm so proud of you. Of course, he doesn't appear to have audio, so.
Yeah, there's no sound, but the image is worth everything else.
The images. For all of you that aren't watching, Mike is in full Santa regalia. Although he apparently is not wearing pants, so I'm not sure what's going on there. He's kind of Donald Ducking it.
Does Santa wear pants?
You got to turn up your gain a bit, bud. I could barely hear you. I think he's contemplating whether Santa wears pants or not. So obviously, you know what people up near Chicago do as their Christmas tradition. They
dress up as pantless Santa.
Pantless Santa. Good times. So while Mike figures out why we can't hardly hear him, do you want to jump into some of the interesting stuff?
Yeah, let's go.
All right, let's do that. So I saw Mike pop something in the Slack the other day that he saw off of one of the Facebook groups. I'm not sure. It's TibbetCom. They appear to be a startup. I was looking at their job postings, right? That kind of, I don't know if you guys ever do this, but I look at companies' job postings on occasion. It gives you kind of an indication of what they're hiring for and maybe where they are in their cycle, right? Especially of the startup. These guys are looking for some like chip designers and some of the big pieces of their company, which is interesting. So it does look like they are getting off the ground, but they do have product apparently that's out in the field. And what it looks like is, what would you call this? An SFP plus optic on steroids. It's got a huge like heat sink on it. It's basically an OLT built into an SFP plus. The thinking is you can take this guy and just plug it into a regular Ethernet switch, and now you've got kind of a GPON setup right there, ready to go. Ethernet SFP plus socket that is fairly commonly found on Ethernet switches routed in many other optical network devices. So it's out in the real world. What I want to know is, how do you actually configure this thing? How do you provision it? Their website is kind of loose on information. I'm assuming you directly connect to this thing. I'm not sure if it's supposed to be standalone, right? Is it supposed to work in an ecosystem? Do you connect to each one of these and configure it? I have no idea, but they apparently go into standard, and maybe Mike has a little bit more information. I reached out to the company to try and get a little bit more information. I haven't gotten really much other than a couple of product sheets, which basically regurgitates what you already see on the website. I have no idea of pricing. They haven't delivered any of that to me yet either, but I don't know. That's fairly interesting. The idea that you could run a GPON setup off of just an Ethernet switch, you don't have to buy the specialized chassis and all that stuff. But I mean, what would you, because since we're just in the mode of speculating, how would you assume they would do something like this, Thomas? You run some specialized software on a server and it calls back home? Or
honestly, I would hope it has some special provisioning mode, like you have to pass it some options through, like, for example, vendor DHCP options, and that would tell it, you know, go to routed or go to bridge mode, or maybe you would kick it into TR-069 mode or something similar. I would think there has to be some kind of, you know, configuration management and provisioning for it, and, you know, or maybe it's, you know, this is optics, so maybe it's even done in a way as docs is, you know, you have a separate frequency or something as, you know, maybe it is something as special or as unique as that, you know, on a specialized frequency, you run a management. Yeah, we've got sound.
Yeah, there's Mike.
So, yeah, you know, it's entirely possible to run management on a different frequency of light than data. So, who knows?
Yeah. It looks like, so they do the OLT, right, which is like the Ethernet side, or, you know, like where you'd plug it into your head end-ish. And then I'm not sure if they do, it looks like they're talking about an ONU. So I'm assuming that means they're selling the client side of it as well, or do you just take any generic unit and shove it on this thing? Right. Ah.
Yeah, I'm assuming they have to have their own client side there to it, right? It can't just be the head end.
Yeah.
At least I would assume so, but who knows?
That I don't know for sure, but I'm going to assume that they have something on the other side. Because most fiber platforms aren't holding to any standard. They're, you know, maybe not intentionally vendor locked, but they may be effectively vendor locked. And so the only way they're going to know for sure if it works is if they make, you know, they make the ONT side of it as well.
Yeah, I'm guessing they're doing both. I know you had ventured a guess on pricing, Mike, and that was maybe based on what somebody else had said. Do you remember? Do you remember what it was?
I don't remember anything.
All right, good deal.
I'm trying to look through Slack to see where I talked about it,
yeah,
but
there's not a lot of information out about it. I think it's fascinating. I like the idea of being able to jump into the pawn stuff without having to like go whole hog on a chassis and doing all that crazy stuff. It almost feels like kind of an open source flavor of it. I mean, they don't talk about the software anywhere in here. So I'm curious how you manage this thing.
Maybe, so there's all kinds of crazy things you could do. Maybe you program it on a specialized device. So you plug it into a specialized device, configure it, and then, you know, tell it to go into like forwarding mode, and then you plug it into your whatever, right?
I mean, you got to be able to update it and make changes out in the field, though, right?
Who knows?
I do see on the website they have a link to an AT&T Open Compute Project Micro OLT specification.
Oh, so maybe it meets that standard?
Or yes, maybe there's some sort of... standard? Right. What it is, I have no idea. And I doubt I'll have a chance to read through it now and turn it into anything useful, but...
Yeah, I mean, there's 100...
On the resources page, I do see they have data sheets for OLT, ONU, ONT, they're all 10 gig. Yeah, so they have a variety of actual pieces.
Anyway, I'm particularly interested in that. I think it would be a cool way to kind of dip your toe in without having to go, without having to augment all of the pieces you're accustomed to. You still get to use everything you want until you get to that last mile piece. I think that's kind of cool.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Honestly, I could come up with, you know, 50 different ways it could be done, but there's not much point to speculating. Yeah. And until they release some, you know, concrete documentation, and then, you know, we'll never know.
Yeah, people are pretty interested.
Maybe I'll try to get Gino to come on and talk about it, since he's the one that shared the picture of him in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, as much as he can talk, he might be under some kind of NDA or something like that, but who knows?
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, if he's taking pictures of it and posting it, you know, surely there's something he can say. It may not be a lot, but better than a stick in the eye.
All right, well, let me do a couple of sellout things while I'm thinking about it. One is my first CCNA course went live. It's the new one in the CCNA series that went live just the other day. I'll put a link to that. So click on it if you feel the need to be bored. I don't know. I just don't like listening to myself. That's why I don't like going back and listening to this stuff. And that's very produced and paced, so it's a very cleaned up version of me. Also, I did the first Greg Talks podcast the other day. That was kind of a filler in between sort of thing, and I'm still trying to figure out the format on that. So anybody that listens to that, I've been getting really good feedback. Not necessarily that it's all positive, but that feedback in of any sort is good. Like, just I want to hear things. So I've been hearing some back and forth about that, what people are interested in hearing and what they aren't. So it sounds like they want an additional guest. That's what most people are saying. They want somebody to bounce stuff off of instead of me just giving a monologue. Can't imagine why. Let's see what else. Let's move into some interesting bits.
Just a quick tangent. Looking at some pricing I got from 10G GPON in a traditional chassis setup. The SF, well, this was an XFP, and it was over $1,000 a piece compared to their standard GPON at $250. So it's 4, 5, 6 times as much money to go 10 gig as standard GPON just at the SFP. Now, given they have the whole ecosystem built into it, would probably cost more, I would assume. Because there's no, you know, there's no module and chassis and supporting infrastructure, so there's, you know, with some amount of intelligence.
Gotcha. I eagerly await some actual information on it. So just kind of putting that out there, and we'll see what comes back. Let's see, while we're throwing out just kind of interesting speculation stuff, is I heard back from MikroTik yesterday, I think, and it sounds like we might be able to get one of the MikroTik representatives on the podcast at some point. It's got to go through final approvals at this point, and I have no idea what the format of that podcast would look like at this point. I'm sure we'd have to sort of talk about it.
I'm sure it would be do not have Tom on it.
I was biting my tongue to not say anything, but you just went for it, Mike.
Straight for the jugular. Yeah. So I'm not sure on any of the details yet, or even when that thing would happen. But you never know. It could happen in the near future. Or from what I understand, is they recorded that last one at the Russian mom, so maybe they would wait until the next U.S. mom, and then they would sit down with us and sort of do the thing there. So I thought that was interesting. Starting to see cracks in the MikroTik infrastructure. I would love to let them have their turn at dictating the narrative, right? It's always been us speculating and us just sort of talking about things and experiences, but actually having them give their side of the story, I think would be really interesting. No story is complete unless you hear both sides of it. And even then, there's some stuff in between. So I'd really like to have them talking about some stuff.
Or, you know, maybe we'll get the Yannis and all of us will be too afraid to say anything. And...
That's what I say. Yannis or Riot, man. I need some big scary dude on here. And the MikroTik bouncer, he just stands at the door, keeps everybody out. Let's see. What else? Let's talk about some wireless ISP stuff. This is an interesting conglomeration of talking points I put on here. I was kind of scattershot today. But Brock was talking about his Cambium APs. Again, I'm trying to work in more WISP stuff. It says WISP in the name. I want to talk more about WISP, at least just to the tiniest degrees. But he was talking about how he had occasional lockups on his Cambium APs in which all the clients would just drop off. And so I was asking him how he actually went about checking for that. You know, how do you monitor for that condition? And it looks like via SNMP, he just alerts for whenever the AP shows zero clients and then sends himself a notification. Then he can kind of take action and do something. I think he was saying something like he wished the Nectonix had some scripting built in where he could see that condition and then reboot the device. I'm assuming, could you imagine doing some kind of script in NetXMS, Thomas, where it was monitoring for a condition, hit zero clients, and then would reach out to a switch, reboot the port? Could you see that kind of thing happening?
Yeah, it would take me about 5 minutes to make that happen. And it's actually what we do on other access points as well, but maybe a little bit more generalized. What we do is we alert when the number of connected clients fluctuates by more than 30%. So in the TXMS, you have the ability to do basically diff, change in value and alarm if the change in the value is higher than lower than a certain percentage, right? Because seeing just zero clients in this particular case, of course, that's what he wants, right? But it might be that, you know, you have 15 clients at an access point and five of them drop, right? So that's probably something that's worth looking into. Right. So like basically anything that's a really high change in a small amount of time usually means something is not okay. Right. It's a out of ordinary situation. So we want to check into it. So those change over time thresholds are super useful as well.
It given what you tell us about your power infrastructure in Slovakia, I would assume that thing is going off all the time.
Oh, yeah, that happens a lot.
And also, it would take me 5 minutes translates to what? It would take Greg 5 hours somewhere in that neighborhood? But even then, it seems like it would be worth it.
So honestly, like if you want the easy button, right, you can just put that into like a config push preset in Unimas and fire a single API call, which is literally one line of curl. right? So it's like click, create threshold, click, create action, paste in a line of curl, and there you go.
And there you go. And it's just that simple. Yeah, I thought that was interesting. Because I was, you know, I was thinking if the AP is having problems, it would, you know, you wouldn't be able to return anything off of it, but it's not, that's not the case. It actually continues to appear to function and everything seems okay. It's just clients can't connect, so he can still pull it and monitor it. I'm assuming for every different access point, there's probably a different way you would need to go about this. You know, if you're using something Ubiquiti or MikroTik or what have you. Everybody's got their own little flavor of, although in MikroTik you could sort of script inside of the APs themselves looking for conditions like that, but you might, it seems like it would be better to do it via, would you prefer to do that kind of thing via an NMS versus actually scripting inside the MikroTik itself for something like this?
It depends on what exactly you are trying to solve, right? Because if you lose connectivity to your management system, then having the script on the particular device is much better, of course. But if you know it's just a wireless problem, then I would do it on the NMS side to be able to catch that condition across the network in a unified way. You know, I add in a new access point, then my NetXMS template would pick it up and everything would just happen automatically. I would also have a history of you know, when this happened, and that can also give you maybe a baseline and a clue on, you know, is it maybe some RF condition that's causing this to happen, or, you know. So it's always better to have as much information as you can centralized, because it makes fault root cause analysis for faults much easier, right? And also it just gives you the data set to be able to look at it and have the history, have the auditing and everything that comes with it.
I was just thinking too, from a logistics perspective, if you've got 100 APs, it's much easier just to update it on the NMS than actually, even if you've got an automated system like Unimus that can go out and push all that stuff, it just seems like it's easier to update it in one place and not worry about having to touch every device, right?
I think so, yeah. Definitely on the NMS side.
And also, say your script works today, if you update tomorrow, who's to say that it's not going to change something in your script on the MikroTik?
So, oh, yeah.
Yes, that might be easier. Man, let's see. Again, with the Cambium stuff, Joe was talking about upgrading from 4.4.2 to 4.4.3. He said almost all of his Elevate radios updated like they should, and that was a very pleasant surprise for him. I'm assuming that it hasn't always been seamless in the past. Are you doing any Elevate stuff, Mike? I know you're a Cambium guy.
I have not, because I'm looking to try to keep like one segment of my network Cambium, one segment Ubiquiti, so that way I can keep abreast of what each vendor is doing, and can give researched feedback, you know, I've actually done this versus someone from outside telling them what they should be doing. You know, I buy your product. I'm currently using your product, and I want it to do this. And my network has kind of a natural separation in it. So I just keep one part Ubiquiti, one part Cambium. Hmm. So I have not elevated because of that. Kind of a tangent. Seems like, you know, Brock, and I've seen several others in different groups, seem to be having no end of issues with EPMP 3000. Maybe it's just one of the APs, you know, maybe it's just a light, I'm not sure.
Right, because meanwhile, there's a light and a regular version, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
But then I know many people that have no problems at all. So it's like, how do some people who are intelligent, you know, it's not like they don't know what they're doing and that's causing it to not work. You know, how do some have so many problems and some are just fine?
Well, I mean, it could also be size of network, right? So maybe Brock's got 100 of these jokers where the other guy's got 10. You know, or five or something of that, or maybe his environmentals are different, or his I mean, there's so many variables in these things, right?
Sure. Well, I think it's being fairly new hardware, you know, maybe they fixed something in hardware, or there was some sort of manufacturing defect that, you know, one batch people got and haven't quite figured out that that's what the problem was. Because there's not enough of them in the field.
Yeah, for sure. And then, yeah, because it seems like most of these guys talking about having issues, it's right on the wireless side, right? Not once it hits the wire and goes back into the network, so.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and I remember a couple other shortcomings, but I think it's not so much that something's wrong as in just it doesn't do what, like, enough. You know, it, you know, this feature isn't in yet, or, you know, SNMP doesn't have that sort of thing.
Right.
Which you'll, you know, you're going to have that anywhere.
Yeah, for sure. All right. You guys ready to talk about a internet BGP question? And I've had discussions, spirited discussions. Can I say that?
Sure.
About it with other people. It's to accept. So if you're pulling full internet routes from your provider, it's to accept default routes as well or not to. So I won't color the conversation until the end. So what's your opinion there, Mike? Should you, if you're pulling full routes from your ISPs, say you've got more than one, should you also accept a default route from them?
I say that you should, when you're signing up for the service, you should definitely have them send it to you. Have them send to you everything. Because it's easier for you to drop whatever you don't want than to get them to add it in the future.
That's for sure.
Now that said, I think that your standard behavior should be to not accept the default. Reason being is that you will run into situations, not just saying that it will, you know, not happen this way, because the only way to protect against that is to have, you know, a BGP optimizer, but to, if there's issues in the network above you where the entire internet is not reachable and you use a default, you could be black holing traffic through upstream A because they have a default. And yet, you know, perhaps they've been regionally isolated and you can only reach their customers or something else off to that router.
So you're saying you've got two ISPs, ISP 1 and ISP 2, and are you only pulling default from them? That's all you're using for your routing? Or are you pulling full and default? I'm trying to get the whatever scenario you're arguing here.
Yeah, no, I guess I was thinking about if you were only default, because if you were, well, I don't know, because if you were, yeah, because if ISPB still had a non-default route, then they would be prevalent. Yeah, like, you know, also trying to think back to the original conversation where it came up, and it's different than some, you know, because I know a lot of people that have CCRs that only do default because it just barfs on more. So yeah, don't do only default is what I should say.
If you have multiple ISPs, don't just use default.
Yeah.
Yeah. How about you, Thomas? Do you have an opinion?
Yeah. So it's a topic with many angles, right? And I mean, yeah, do you just pull default or do you pull full routes or do you pull both? Right. But I think that decision, more importantly, should be informed by how much, I want to say, automation or monitoring you have in your network, right? So, for example, if you do pull full routes, and then, you know, do you pull default as well? And if so, when do you switch the default, you know? Because if you pull it, then, you know, it's, yeah, potentially you might never switch it even if there is an outage. But if you don't pull it and you do a manual default, or you don't do a default at all, right? You might not want the default route in your routing table at all. So it's like, do you pull it or do you configure it manually, and do you even have it? And I think that decision really should be informed by how much automation and monitoring you have in your network, right? Do you have a system that actively monitors the outbound and inbound paths that can make the logic and decisions happening for you, you know, or do you pull those defaults and just hope that, you know, when something goes out, the default route switches automatically from provider to provider by, you know, whatever they basically advertise to you, right? So I don't think there is a simple, you know, you should do X explanation for this, right? It depends on what you want to do, what the infrastructure in your network can handle, and how much logic and automation and route monitoring do you have, and or are you just, you know, do you just want to have complete manual control and not have it in there, and, you know, hope that that doesn't cause any issues? So I don't think there is a straight answer.
I do have some more. If you have any default routes, then you cannot use unicast reverse path filtering to reject, you know, packets that aren't in your routing table because the default route is present.
You can use loose filtering.
Sure, but then loose, I guess, going back to a failure of MikroTik, which they've said that they will fix it. It just wasn't, you know, waiting for the new routing to do it. But the Linux kernel, you can specify loose or strict per interface. So you can do, you know, strict facing a customer, loose facing, you know, transit. MikroTik is just off strict or loose, which...
Yeah, I've run into problems one time with Universe, or rather, Unicast. What am I trying to say? Unicast reverse path forwarding, right? So it's the idea of when a packet enters a router, it looks at the routing table and makes sure that it's going to, that it entered from a valid destination, right? So it looks at the route table and says, hey, if I want to leave this router, go out of Ether 1, and it makes sure that if traffic comes in, Ether 1 from that destiny, right? It's like, it's just making sure that it's sourced from the right interfaces. And I ran into
basically
a problem.
Basically, it's just spoofing protection.
Yeah. I ran into a problem where it used to be Quest, before they got acquired by CenturyLink, had that enabled on one of their upstreams. And we had a customer that didn't want their subnets being advertised to Quest, but they wanted, you know, they were fine with their traffic exiting. They just didn't want to return in there. And so since we weren't advertising, you know, that /24 to Quest, anytime that customer's traffic hit over there, it just Pac-Maned it and ate it all. So we ended up having to advertise a /24 prepended like 10 times out of that carrier to meet the requirement there. So that was unfortunate. It wasn't a deal breaker, right? But it did kind of gum up the works for a little bit there while we figured out what was going on and why the traffic was magically disappearing whenever it hit Quest. And took us a little while to get to the right level of engineer before they could tell us why it was doing said action.
Oh, sure. But and then, yeah, I'll say that's a fairly atypical configuration where,
yeah,
you're going to use it for outbound but no inbound.
Yeah, they didn't care about that. Let's see. So in my scenarios, in my data centers, I always accept default from the carriers as well as full tables, right? So if you've got the full table from multiple upstreams, the default route should really never come into play, right? Like, because you're always going to have a better path one way or the other. And I'm not necessarily using it for me trying to actually route utilizing it. The idea being, I actually have some customers that downstream customers that peer with me via BGP. And I would say 90% of those guys just want a default route from me. That's all they want, because they might be using me as a backup link and they're primarying off of somebody else, right? And if I'm going to hand somebody default, there's an option in your BGP sessions wherein I can just always give them default, whether I have it in my tables or not. But I honestly don't want to hand somebody a default route unless I'm legitimately getting that route from an upstream. So what happens if, worst case scenario, all of my upstreams fail and I have no route to the internet and I'm always handing that customer a default route? Those guys that actually go through the trouble of engineering these networks, even if maybe their equipment can only support a single default and they're using me for that, I would start blackholing all of their traffic, right? Because I'm handing them an always default and yet I have no upstreams. Wherein, if I pull that, which is what I do in my scenario, I pull the default from all of my upstreams, and I only advertise it to downstream neighbors if it exists at my table. So I'm only going to have it if my upstreams are there. If they all fail, then I don't black hole all those people. And so to me, it's not negatively impacting my network, and it only adds value to those downstream customers. So it makes sense for me. I would assume a lot of people listening to this don't BGP peer with a lot of their customers, right? It's not, they're not that kind of network. So maybe there wouldn't be an advantage for them, but there absolutely is for me. So I have a use case for it, and I haven't had anybody really argue against that too hard. Tom Smith was trying to for a minute, but I think he saw the light at the end of the conversation. So I was just curious if any of the listeners could argue with that. And I'm sure there's some smart guys, John Osman, Nick Baraglio. I'm sure you guys have some rationale why that's a bad idea, and I would love for you to tell me why. Come at me nicely, right? Don't come at me hot. Come at me nice. But I mean, that seems like a valid use case, does it not? Do you guys?
Yeah. Yeah. I could potentially see that also being, you know, internally, if you had routers inside your network that were only default capable, for the same reasons that the external person may only have a default, maybe you have a reason internally, and wouldn't want your provider edge to pass that through to, whatever tower if it doesn't exist.
Well, I use that with gateway routers a lot too. So I've got, backbones that accept internet connections, and they're kind of the core of the network. And then I've got gateway routers, which I terminate customers on. And I like to keep those guys as lightly loaded as possible. So I will, via BGP, I will collect all of the internal routes, right, that are learned inside my network. And I will, I'll accept routes from customers, right, and I'll pass those up to the backbones. But honestly, those gateways, they don't need the full internet route table. Right, they're all they need to know is how to get to Sesame Street, how to get to one of the backbone routers so that they can actually exit the network. And so keeping those guys lightly loaded means I can use a router with a smaller CPU. I can have those guys converge faster. Some of the older equipment I used to use, when it was holding full routes, even though they weren't being taxed, if there was a change on one of my ISPs, say one went down or one came up as those routes loaded, CPU would spike and I would lose SNMP. While I may not have dropped any packets, SNMP was lost for like 30 minutes, right? While it just kind of settled down. So it's kind of a nice way to keep those routers as streamlined as possible, keep them as lightly loaded as possible, and still meet all the requirements. So it worked well for me. And it continues to work well for me in a lot of different places. Wah, wah, wah.
But, I would assume that there is a way where you could script MikroTik, potentially easier because there's a lot of powerful scripting, where you could say accept a default route from this peer until the table is loaded, or not there's a table loaded event, but until routes reach something or sufficient time has passed so that you don't black hole traffic while the table is being loaded. But then once your table is loaded, you don't need it, and then you can shut it off.
I mean, you could probably do like a floating static route for default. If you had one ISP per backbone, or maybe if you have multiple, you could have a floating static route so the administrative distance was a lot higher on that static route, and as BGP came in, it would kind of take over, and that one would get nullified, I guess. It would become invalid as those routes came in. If you needed like an ultimate backup sort of scenario.
Thinking in CCR land where, it could take you several minutes for the full table to load, at which point, a bunch of traffic may be dying. Whereas if it had a default to start with, it'll forward packets. And then, once your table is actually load, however much time afterwards, then it would route them optimally.
You know, I think it's as fun as my optimizers, whenever a peer goes into a failure state, so say an interface blinks or something like that. So we had Talia a week and a half ago or whatever. Man, I don't know. Everything bleeds together. But they went down. It put them into probation. And so in that scenario, I filter out everything except for default. And I just I set the local preference super high on it so it doesn't get used. It took from the time that Talia's router crashed and came back, and it was due to a configuration error that they did. They eventually came back with an RFO. You know, everybody's hammering that same peering router all at the same time, so it's just it crawls. It took 7.5 minutes just to get the default route off their router. I was thinking, man, this, somebody's having a really bad day off of that. But yeah, 7.5 minutes for some really big Juniper chassis-based router. So it's hard to complain about Microtech CCRs being slow sometimes. It's like everybody in the right conditions can be pretty slow. It's all about perspective.
Sure.
Let's see. If we beat that one to death, there was a Unify announcement that I found interesting. They have a new product out. Man, dude, they have been busted. I thought they were only supposed to do like a new product once a quarter. They've been really been pumping out stuff here lately. It's the Unify building-to-building bridge. 60 gigahertz paired radios. They're really cute looking. A couple of look, they kind of look like the Dyna dishes, like little small versions of those, like the Microtech ones. But 60 gigahertz, I'm not, what does it say, the range? 500, up to 500 meters, it says. I'm not sure if that's like at full modulation or not, but it's got its really cute aiming technology. So on either side, kind of imagine the ears on your head, it's got LED rings on either side, and that'll turn red if it needs you to tilt it away. And so that way you can kind of move it back and forth just using the big LED rings on either side. I guess that would be an interesting way to also see if it got out of align, unless you have to put it into some special align mode, which actually might be the case. But they're paired together already, right? So the idea being you can buy these things that come in two packs. You could just throw them up and they magically bridge across, but they're retail $500. So it looks like it's got a smartphone app
for a pair.
For a pair, yeah, at 500 meters. And so that's, you know, honestly, that's over twice the price of the Microtech equivalent that already has these guys beating the market. Although these guys are 60 gigahertz with a 5 gig failover built into them, which the Microtechs don't. They're just 60 gig only. So I guess you're getting that additional backup radio in there. I guess that's the selling point, right?
It seems Ubiquiti is doing quite a bit of 60 gig stuff recently, which, yeah, we can suspect fairly highly that that's very inspired by the Microtech success in the 60 gig space. But yeah, the pricing is rough.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they are coming out with an air fiber 60 for service providers. Being a unified building-to-building bridge, this is enterprise-focused. So it's not going to be, you know, it's not somebody that's going to go buy a whole ton of these, like, you know, Justin Miller's network, where they have hundreds of these things. You know, you might have one pair, or you might have two pair. So probably a less cost-sensitive customer, given the volume.
And it also goes into the Unify ecosystem, right? So it connects to the Unify controller. Yeah. So if you've got a big Unify deployment, this bops right in and you can go to town from there. But as I saw somebody else saying, does that mean we have to install Unify if we just want to throw up a bridge someplace? And I'm assuming it says they're prepared, so I'm guessing you don't necessarily have to. It's just if you want to make modifications afterwards or you want to do updates, you have to do it through a controller.
Oh, you know, you want to monitor it in any meaningful way.
Yeah. There you go. So yet another hardware notification from Ubiquiti. Coming in hot.
So I had a funny side story to the peering stuff, but you beat me too with the Ubiquiti stuff.
What's that?
So you mentioned, and this is a tangent, of course, but you mentioned many people don't peer with their customers, right? So many years ago, this was, I think, like 8, 9 years ago, 2011 or something like that, I used to peer with some of my customers using OSPF. And these were completely separate customers, but at the time, 8 years ago, not a lot of equipment supported BGP. And you can actually do really good stuff with OSPF if you are running OSPF in a separate instance and you peer with the customer. But so our requirement specifically was, that the customer had multiple routers for redundancy, of course, for high availability, and we had multiple routers to the customer. Also, because the customer requested specifically, certain SLA, right? So we put multiple routers on our end, he put multiple routers on his end, and then, of course, we routed some subnets to them. They weren't an AS, they just were purchasing a subnet, a routed subnet from us specifically. So what we did is we spun up a separate OSPF instance for that customer, and we used a NSSA area. So they would be able to push type 7 to us, and we would just push them a default route, which served a great purpose that basically they could tell us routing information, which of their gateways we should push traffic to them, and we were pushing them a default route, so that would tell them which of our gateways they should push traffic to us through. And so that was a rather interesting use case where, you can actually use even OSPF for full-featured customer peering.
Guys,
And so yeah, many, many years ago, but it worked.
and the
And
keyword was
yeah.
you spun up an additional instance, right? So it was completely
Yeah,
separated from your
that's the keyword.
yeah.
It has to
Don't
be
add
in a
them
separate
to
instance.
don't add them to area zero in your
Bad
existing
idea.
infrastructure.
Well, so actually, honestly, you could, because since this is NSSA, they cannot push type 1, 2, 3 to you. Well, type 1, of course, that's the router, so yeah. But they cannot push type 3, they cannot push type 7, sorry, type 5, right? So the only thing you have to worry about is type 7. And you could run routing filters on their OSPF connection and filter those type 7s to only a specific IP address or subnet that you want them to advertise. And since this is a NSSA area, you aren't exposing your internal topology to them because you are just pushing a default route to
Right.
them.
And the idea being if there it's an NSSA area, it can't be the backbone, so it's going to be a different area. And then
Yep.
also if there's fluctuations inside of an alternate area, those fluctuations only cause reconvergence on the routers inside that area. It's not going to bleed into the rest of your network. So you would be sort of isolated. So if they started flapping, it would only affect the routers that happen to have an interface in that area, right?
Not even that. It would only affect the dedicated router, the DR and the VDR in that area, because only the DR and the BDR do these the shortest path calculations.
Right. Well, I mean, no, I thought the BDR, the DR and the BDR. So the DR accepts all the LSAs from all of the routers inside that area, and then it redistributes all of that information, all those LSAs out to everybody else. And then everybody individually runs their SPF calculation based on what their LSDB looks like to them, right?
So I would have to check, but I think, and I might be completely wrong, but I think actually it's that, and this is all inside of a single layer 2, right? Because you have
Right.
a DR and a BDR per layer 2, but inside of a single layer 2, everybody exchanges LSAs, but only the DR and the BDR calculate the spanning, the shortest path through the Dijkstra algorithm, and then the DR and the BDR distribute the calculated topology, but I might be wrong.
That's interesting. Well, the only reason I say it is that I've just gone to, through the CCNA routing section, and I know in Cisco. Everybody since so you're right, and so on a broadcast subnet, say there's four routers, there's going to be a DR, a BDR, and then everybody else is going to be a DR other. And those DR others, while they do send hello messages to each other, they only make it to the two-way relationship. They don't make it to full adjacency, right? You only make full to your upstreams, and so you're sending your LSAs to those to the DR. The DR will redistribute it. That way, everybody has an identical version of link state database on that area itself, and then based on their view of the network and that LSDB, they calculate, they'll run the Dijkstra algorithm on themselves and calculate best path and enter that into their own RIB. And then once everybody's done that, it's considered converged, right? Everybody's settled down. Everybody has the same view of the network. But it might be different on MikroTik and the Linux routing engine that they're using. I just know in Cisco, that's how they do it, for sure.
Honestly, I would have to check the OSPF.
Jesus, we're getting deep into the weeds, well, but...
Yeah. But yeah, the point was, you know, NSSAs and Type 7s are super useful in OSPF. If you do, you know, they exist for a reason, and, you know, if you are using it for a valid use case, and, you know, then that use case is entirely valid, and, you know, OSPF being faster and available in much cheaper grade or you know, much less professional grade equipment than BGP. And of course, then there's licensing. You know, on many vendors, you need to license various different layer 3 features, right? And OSPF is usually, first of all, either available out of the box or you know, much cheaper to license. Yeah. For example, with some of our HP chassis, right? OSPF is right there out of the box from the factory. And I'm not saying you should run, you know, OSPF on a HP chassis.
There's a lot of firewalls, too, that will run OSPF, but they won't run BGP. So in those scenarios, I mean, it can be extremely useful. There's been a lot of customers that have come in the data centers and their firewalls most certainly don't support BGP, or at least the version they have doesn't support it, or the license level they have doesn't support it. So in those instances, we'll run a first hop protocol, first hop redundancy protocol like VRRP, right? Which isn't exactly the same, but sometimes can get around its limitations.
VRRP is wonderful, but that requires you to have a shared layer 2, right? Which, for example, if you are distributing to a campus, right, you might have two completely different entry points, but, you know. But there's many ways to do this, of course. This was just one crazy example from many years ago where, you know, we actually peered with a customer using OSPF.
For sure, man. Where there's a will, there's a way, right? You can always make it happen one way or the other. With what you have, there's a pretty good chance you can. So speaking of Thomas and how smart this dude is, Unimus now has Slack dev. So I was curious if you wanted to, because that's a brand new feature. You've been working on that one for a hot minute. I was curious if you wanted to elaborate on that.
Yeah, so there's actually quite a few new things, but yeah, Slack divs, everybody was asking for it, so we just assigned one of the developers to it, and a couple of weeks later, support for Slack divs. So configuration change notifications now go into Slack. It's full graphical, you know, it shows you what changed and everything else. Because Slack being a messaging platform, you know, before we just had Unimus send messages, you know, configuration has changed. So it would tell you it has changed, but there wasn't like a full graphical diff. And people asked for it, so we made it, and now there is.
Which is baller. It seems like such a small thing, but it is so huge for me personally that every morning I'll log in and I'll look at, I mean, prior to the Slack diffs, I haven't upgraded to that version yet, but prior to that, you know, it just does send you a message. It says, hey, here's all the devices. These are the ones that updated. And if I ever see anything that's bizarre, you know, I will then just pop into Unimus and say, what exactly changed? And it's always something innocuous. It just, you know, freaks me out sometimes. You know, once you start getting enough admins in the network and you start delegating change, you know, to various people, especially stuff on the periphery that doesn't really matter. You see little odds and ends boops happen here and there. I think it's awesome. And now the ability to not even have to jump over to Unimus, now it's just going to show me the diffs right there in the Slack. I mean, that's perfect. Because sometimes, you know, I'll be a little busy, which is code for I'm feeling a little lazy and I won't jump over to Unimus. I'll just ask in the Slack channel, like, hey, who made changes on this? So this way I'll actually see them ahead of time without having to bug them. I think that's killer.
So up until now, we had this in email. You know, we already supported full graphical diff change notifications in email. But yeah, Slack is more comfortable.
I like it because it's, I mean, just by nature, it's so much quicker and collaborative. You know, I can just pop in there at whoever and say, why did you choose to do this really quick? Just curious what the requirement was that made you think to do that.
That's a nice way of putting that.
Well, no, it's just, you know. It's...
What was the requirement that caused this?
So I have this disability. I have this dysfunction in my brain. I'll be in the car with a wife, and she'll be driving, and in my head, I'm thinking, she's going to turn right, and I need her to turn left right now. And she'll make that right turn, and I'll calmly say, how come you went right here? You know? And she's like, why do you always tell me I'm driving wrong? I'm just like, you're not driving wrong. In my brain, I know if you went left, we would have saved 30 seconds on the commute, which is inconsequential. It does not matter. But my brain needs to know why she took the least efficient path. Like, it drives me crazy. It's like having a splinter in your hand, or, you know, those, like, on the corner of your nail, it kind of comes up a little bit and it just keeps driving you crazy. It's like that in my brain. So it's one of those things, if somebody does a configuration change and they do it in a way that just doesn't seem efficient, I need to know why. It's not necessarily bad, and I won't necessarily going to change it. I just need to know why. I needed to be okay with my brain. Oh, my God. So sorry about that. I'm not saying people are doing things wrong. I'm not putting that out into the world. I'm saying I am a broken person. And there's certain things that help me sleep at night, and that is one of them. I just need to know. Holy cow. Man. So, let's go into something a little lighter. I saved Thanksgiving the other day. We were at my mom's house, and the internet connection was down. And, of course, how are we going to continue to not talk to each other and converse, you know, and bring up old family wounds than to watch television streamed over her Roku, right? So it's like she lives in Baltimore. She comes down here to a duplex that she owns every so often. She, you know, so she rents out one side and keeps one for her. And what I happen to have was an SXT SQ Lite 2. It's, you know, it's a little square Microtik 2 gigahertz panel. I keep a bunch of crap in the trunk of my car, and that was one of them. And she's befriended one of her neighbors. And so I got her just to ask her neighbor what her Wi-Fi network name and password was. And we pointed that joker in the window at that lady's house and blasted into the house. And I just rebroadcast, excuse me, with some other Microtik. I think I had like a map light or something. Connected the TV up. The day was saved thanks to a neighbor who I'm probably giving brain cancer right now to. No, I don't want to perpetuate that. We have enough people complaining about 5G and stuff like that. It's really nice to have a high gain, a 2 gigahertz antenna in the back of your car, just in case of emergencies. You know, like you might have to talk to your creepy uncle about, I don't know, politics.
Why send them the same
Ugh. Yeah. Save yourself. I just thought, have you guys ever heroed out something like that on spur of the moment?
It gets a spur of the moment, but with minimal planning. Then I went on a family trip to Colorado one time, and the place said, you know, we have internet. I thought, great. You know, there's going to be, you know, internet in our, you know, condo that we're renting or whatever. There wasn't. There was Wi-Fi in the lobby. So I was like, yo, I think we're going to be there for like 10 days. So I just bought from StreakWave. I bought like a Nano Station 2 and something else. And I mounted it on like a pole outside of the unit, ran the wire, you know, fished it through a like hole and a crack in the window, and then into the place, and then you know, everyone's making fun of me for doing this and spending money to do this, and yet everybody loved having Wi-Fi when I was done.
You know, I've stayed in hotels before where the hotel, the Wi-Fi in the hotel was like $40 a day, but the one right across the parking lot, it was free. So I just, yeah, you just put like a directional antenna and pointed at the other hotel and just bar their Wi-Fi for the couple of days that you're going to be there. I mean, it's sort of a legitimate use.
I mean, again, this was some years ago, but I went to Venice, and in the hotel in Venice, they had free Wi-Fi in the hotel, but only up to 1 gigabyte of data use, and then you had to pay. So, you know, there is enough MAC addresses to keep you going for a long time to switch between those free 1 gigabytes. So, I mean, yeah.
You just keep changing Macs every... So did you write a script to change your Mac like every hour?
No.
I was just going to say that. I was like, yep, he probably made a script that, you know, once the interface traffic got to 900 megs, he would change the MAC address and reset the counter.
See, thinking about it, that would have been very easy to do. But no, I changed those Macs manually.
It's always next time, bud. Good times. All right, so you use a lot of Raspberry Pis, Thomas. And this, Jeff said this a little while back, but he has some video displays. And he was saying that he does like 720p or 1080p video on some Pi 4s that are running 24/7. Like pulling shit off there, and he said that it caused the micro SD cards to heat up and eventually warp, kind of bend. So he was saying his go-to is to use a USB drive to actually hold the video files themselves. And you were saying potentially, I guess, depending on the size of the video files, right, you could do it in a RAM disk.
Yeah, so I just don't like having extra components when you don't need them. And specifically USB drives, especially, you know, cheap little USB flash disks are prone to fail as well. And like, for example, Raspberry Pi's 4s run quite hot. Yeah, so I would never run a 4 without cooling. Right, in our Pi cluster that we have as well, you know, each individual Pi 4 is cooled, actively cooled. And but if I don't have a choice, or if it's in an enclosure somewhere where it's hot, you know, yeah, depending on the file size, I would put those files, you know, at boot, just put them in a RAM disk, and then just keep playing them from a RAM disk. That way you can still keep just a single, you know, SD card, and you don't have to use any additional USBs. And if this is like a signage application or just, you know, connected to a TV running ads somewhere all day, then the new Pi 4s, they come, you know, up to 4 gigs of RAM. And if you want a decent USB stick, it's going to be cheaper to actually buy a 4 gig RAM version than a 2 gig RAM version with the USB stick, right? So if you can fit all of your files into those 2 gigabytes of data, which like 2 gigabytes for ads or signage is like, you know, that's a lot. You can fit hours of ads into that space, which, you know, if you are just replaying them over, then, you know, they can easily fit into 2 gigs and you don't have to have additional components.
Cool. Good tip. I have yet to use Raspberry Pis for anything other than running emulators for retro video games. So I haven't actually used them for anything useful the way you guys do. But
I mean, I just got my first one like a month ago, not even a month ago. And the application I bought it for, the application doesn't seem to be working quite right, but I don't have the time to troubleshoot to see if I screwed it up or if the application sucks. So it's still just sitting there. But, I mean, I was pretty happy with what I bought. Pi 4 with a PoE hat. It came with, I guess, 32 gig SD card. And then the case I got, I think they call it like a secure Pi or something, where it has covers that you can put in when you assemble the case, and it actually prevents access to all the ports, except there on the Ethernet, there's like a little breakout, so you can have it just kind of on a dongle, you know, and nobody can plug stuff in. You know, obviously they can take a screwdriver to it, take it apart and do stuff. You know, it's not going to fool someone with intent, but it'll keep someone from just popping something in and seeing what's going on.
That's cool.
And it was like $7 for that case.
All right. Well, what's the coolest Christmas present you bought somebody this year? I found.
Well, you start. We see you're eager to show off.
So. I found these. So they are I use these little notebooks a lot, right? Just these little personal notebooks where you can keep notes and stuff like that. And as good as digital note taking and all that stuff is, there's something, I don't know, there's just something about making quick notes on a, you know, a piece of paper or drawing a quick sketch. You know, nothing really, so I'm so visual that when I'm talking to somebody, sometimes it's so much easier for me to convey my point if I can just open up my notebook and then just draw a little diagram really quick and get to the same page with somebody. So I'm a big proponent of keeping little notebooks. And these guys are, what, like 9 inches by like 5 inches? You know, just the little ones with the rubber bandy strip on them. And I found these for any of you Beetlejuice fans. It says Handbook for the Recently Deceased. And it even has like the picture on there. And it kind of like looks weathered and stuff, which was the handbook manual for people that were newly deceased. In the movie, that they would hand him this book. It's like, this is how to deal with the afterlife. So I thought it was really, really cool. It's really well done. They're like embossed and stuff like that. So that was my favorite find that I got this year. I haven't given them out yet, but I have them. How about you guys? What's your favorite find so far? Oh, you guys suck. You guys didn't get anything.
You know, mine's pretty good because my wife loves shopping, so she takes care of everything else other than whatever I have to get her. And she wants this little coffee, tea station, like a little table-covered hutch thing. And I said, when you figure out what one you want, I'll buy that for you for Christmas. She was happy, so
yeah, rock and roll. What about you, Thomas? What's the story, bud?
So, as lame as it sounds, I don't actually buy Christmas presents, and I tell people not to buy me Christmas presents. It's just a deal that we have. So, no, that's how I do stuff. And yeah, as lame as it sounds, it's just how it is.
Well, yeah, it's like my wife and I. If we want to get each other something during the year, we just do it. We don't wait for like special holidays or whatever. So. We usually get each other something. So I bought her as many varieties of gummy worms as I could find. She likes those a lot. So twin snakes, those are the best, right? It comes with a kind of a sweet and sour one stuck together. So that's what we did. And I was looking through our Amazon list because I was looking for something when something shipped, and I saw she got me a pair of new cycle shoes. They're like neon yellow. So I'll look like a baller, I guess. There you go.
I would say the best Christmas present I probably ever bought anybody was when I bought Tom Smith the Donald Trump 2016 Christmas tree ornament.
I think he actually put it on his tree as well. Are you going to go ahead and buy him a 2021?
I'm thinking about it.
You might as well.
But in terms of, so on our notes here, it just says Christmas traditions, and you know, we were kind of talking in our internal Slack about, you know, somebody like, you know, who's gonna be here, and somebody had a cookie and hot chocolate party.
Oh, that was Miller, his kid. Yeah, he was quick to say, "Oh no, it's for my kid. It's for my kid." Yeah.
So then there was various conversations about that, and so. With my Santa getup, I also have a cup of hot chocolate. I have a straw because obviously it's difficult. I don't want to get this thing dirty.
Are you a marshmallow guy or not? Two kind of people in the world.
I do like marshmallows in it, but if I'm making it, that's more work, so I'm not going to do it.
Right, fair enough. Just so that you acknowledge that it's far better with marshmallows.
Yeah, yeah. But I just want to point out here that my cup, I don't know if the camera will show it. This cup came from SAF Technica a long time ago. I forgot about it because I don't.
Looks like a subnetting chart or something.
Modulation QAM, bits per hertz, capacity increase, and then channel bandwidths with, it will tell you the throughput of a licensed link if you know the channel width. And then the modulation.
You're such a nerd. Jeez. We call them in our family, we call hot chocolate, we call it lattes, because we were going on this this hayride with our kid. I think he was like 7 at the time, and he was telling somebody, or no, what was he saying? He was like, we got him hot chocolate, and he was like, ooh, we're gonna look at the lights and drink our lattes. So from then on, man, it's like, yeah, we're drinking lattes, bud. Here we go. Running joke, I love it. All right, man, well, you guys have anything else you want to plop in before the end?
I also have the cookies.
Dude, you do that, the hot chocolate and the cookies. They're branded.
Branded from a company that I buy fiber stuff from. This is a chocolate-covered Oreo.
Rock and roll. I think somebody bought me a tape measure from one of my vendors one time. And then occasionally I'll get food and I just distribute it to the knock. Let those guys have it.
I take it.
It's usually not very good food, so I definitely let them have it. You know what's funny? It's like I unload everything on those guys. I mean, they're going to be diabetic, and it's all my fault. So, like, after every Halloween, we just pick out the little bits we want, and we just dump it on them. And within, like, a day and a half, it's all gone, man. They just – because there's like, 3 shifts of guys. It was mostly, you know, like, IT guys just sitting around. And so they just sit there and continually graze on that stuff. Whatever happens to be in there, it will disappear quickly.
At the risk of screwing up my deal as well, it's the same thing we do when we have like go to some party or something and we have like any pastry or sweet stuff. I that ends in the office as well, and then it's taken care of.
Yeah, I just need that stuff away from me. That's the thing. I just need it out of arm's reach, because I will just sit there and snack and snack until I'm like sick. It happens every time. Good times. All right, well, let's put a bow on it. Thomas, if people want to get a hold of you out in the real world or on the internet, how do they do that?
Yeah, as usual, just Google for me. I'm pretty much everywhere. So if you just Google my name, you'll find some way to contact me. And of course, there's always unimus.net. We have live chat on there. If you ask for me, I'm there as well. And yeah, that's it.
Baller. All right, Mikey, what's the story?
Leave me alone.
All right, fair enough. And that's not usually what you hear Santa saying, so it's well, I mean, it's the build up to Christmas, right? He really needs to concentrate. He's got to focus.
Dealing with vendors, dealing with contractors, dealing with cities. I've got a guy at a city for a fiber permit that should have been issued 6 months ago, because that's when everybody else issued theirs for this project. On the plan, I happened to put all the customer drops, because I had to design them anyway for capacity purposes. So now he's commenting on my plans, every single customer drop. What's this? Why is this on private property? Why is this across someone else? I'm like, and I have to respond to this in official capacity. And I've already done so.
Yeah.
Twice.
Yeah, we try.
And it's still a reason for holding back our permit.
Oh, man, we try and sanitize everything before we send it to anybody. Just it's like I give you the bare minimum amount of information that you need to complete this stuff. Because it's just, oh, man, that stuff gets complicated so fast. But it's live and learn, right? I'm assuming the next time you do this, you won't include all those additional reports.
Well, the next time someone else will be doing it. Oh, so it won't be my problem anymore.
Fair enough. All right. All right. Well, if you want to get a hold of Greg, it's greg@gregsoul.com. Or really, honestly, the best way is via the Little Brothers with Slack. And you go to patreon.com/thebrotherswith. You sign up there, chunk us a couple of bones, and we send you an invite to the Slack. And a lot of good discourse there, communication, and direct messages are so easy to get a hold of. You know what's funny is I was looking at our breakdown. And it's usually like 90% of the messages are public, right, in the channels, and then like 10%. It's actually less than that. And then I looked at our work one, like from the data center, and it is the complete opposite. There's about like 1-2% in open channels, and then everything else is direct message, which I thought was interesting, kind of indicative of a work environment, right? But to me, what it really said is that the Slack is there for public collaboration, and I love that, right? So while we could just go direct and ask somebody a specific question, people are doing it in the channel so that everybody else can learn from it and everybody else can chime in, which I think is great, because I learned so much from just tagging in on people's conversations. You know, it kind of feeds into my voyeuristic nature, apparently. I like to watch. What do you know? So, questions and comments, keep them coming. Thank you guys for spending a little bit of time with us. Happy holidays, you know, whatever religious affiliation you have or background, you know, enjoy the holiday in whatever way you see fit. And thank you guys for listening, and appreciate you kids for coming in and joining the cast on this vacation weekend. So thank you, everybody.
I'm
telling you, you don't know what you are missing. Ideas and some good comedy given. If you missed the show already, don't worry, you're forgiven.